then buried the strongbox, filled with the wealth of St. Dominicus Kirke, at its foot. Now the chest sat looking impregnable and snug at the bottom of a 6-foot shaft, dug with machined precision to fit it exactly.
How heavy is that thing, Father?
73 kilograms.
My grandfather started to question the precision of Father Nichols' reply, then realized Alwy weighed it.
He made a complete inventory, which I mailed to the congregation for divine worship at the Curia for safekeeping. My grandfather felt that he would have liked to meet this tragic but admirably methodical young man. He hesitated, believing he already knew the answer to the question he was going to ask.
"Maybe Alwy had some thoughts about digging up the box," he said. "Where is he?"
"No doubt he would have done," Father Nichols said. "Unfortunately, the young man you killed today in the street, to whom I gave extreme unction."
"Ah," said my grandfather, "I'm sorry about that."
"I was able to comfort him at last," the priest said, "as you saw."
My grandfather had seen something he was not prepared to concede or even acknowledge. He managed a nod.
"He had been shooting at you with the bow."
"That's right." My grandfather nodded back toward the jeep. Diddens appeared to have fallen asleep. "Diddens got an arrow in the foot. I had to remove it.
Alwy was a fine archer. You're lucky that the injury to his hand spoiled his aim. You have some Russian trooper to thank for your life."
My grandfather nodded. Then he and Father Nichol went back to staring down into the hole in the ground. My grandfather made out a groove running down the right side of the shaft. There was a similar faint groove down the left side.
"He used a block and tackle, the one he used for the coffins. He passed it around the bottom of the chest, through those grooves."
Father Nichol nodded. He anticipated my grandfather's next question.
"It was made chiefly of wood,"
the old priest said with an air of regret.
"Ah,
I'm afraid we also burned the rope."
My grandfather had Gatto back the jeep through the churchyard gate and around the edge of the burial ground. Gatto threaded the gaps among headstones until he was alongside the hole. Outside Bonn, Auenbau and my grandfather had come upon the wingless but otherwise intact fuselage of a small flying bomb, a guided missile, we would call it today, jammed into a frozen pond like a cigar butt into the sand of an ashtray. It was of a design no one had ever seen. It was stuck fast in the ice. So Auenbau and my grandfather had gotten hold of a welding torch and improvised a winch out of salvage, spare parts, and a length of chain. They freed the Enzian, as it later would turn out to have been codenamed, packed it up, and shipped it back to Wright Field. Now my grandfather paid 10 feet of chain from the drum mounted to the front of the jeep. He tossed it over the limb of a bare chestnut tree that must shade the church wonderfully in summer, then passed it around Gatto's waist a few times. He cinched it at the back, leaving about 7 feet free at the end. He tied a piece of stiff fence wire to the loose end of the chain and gave it to Gatto. He and Diddens picked up Gatto and turned him upside down so that he dangled head first from the branch of the chestnut. A dagger trimmed in nickel with a black scabbard fell out of Gatto's pocket and hit the ground with a thump. It was decorated with a silver eagle. Diddens got in the jeep and backed it up a little closer to the tree. Gatto swung over the hole. A silver ring ornamented with a death's head fell out of his pocket, and then a wristwatch, whose face, when my grandfather retrieved it, had a pair of lightning bolts in the 12 spot.
"I'm sorry," Gatto said. "Tell him I'm sorry."
Father Nichol said that it was nothing, but my grandfather thought the old priest looked scandalized. My grandfather wrapped his arms around Gatto's hips and aimed him. Diddens paid out more chain, and Gatto's head went into the hole.
"No," Gatto said. "No, goddammit, I can't do it. Take me out."
They winched Gatto back up out of the hole. He was crying. My grandfather took his place. Diddens and Gatto turned him upside down and fed him down into the hole. His shoulders barely cleared the sides, and his body blocked most of the light. My grandfather thought he could smell spring stirring in the darkness of the hole. It was a meaty odor, a smell of worms. He dangled from the taut end of the chain.
He put out his hands. His fingers touched the cold zinc that clad the chest. He braced himself with his left hand, and with the right hand fed the wire through the groove in the right wall of the shaft. He poked it through the underside of the chest, and then kept pushing until the tip of it emerged through the groove in the left-hand wall. He tied a knot in the chain and called out that he was ready. Nothing happened. He called out again, louder. He kicked with his heels at the chain that held him suspended. It thrummed meaningfully. Still he dangled, a Jew on a chain sharing a straight grave with the bone of a saint. The smell of worms began to cloy. It had the wet blanket heaviness of his own exhalations. He was suffocating. The Luftwaffe had been all but knocked out of the fight, but every once in a while a stray Messer would fly overhead with its MG-131s chattering and flashing. Maybe Diddon's, Gatto, and Father Nickel had been strafed. Maybe the old priest had decided to punish him for killing Alois, and Gatto for looting the corpses of dead SS men. But as blood filled his head, it seemed to bring an odd tranquility. Suffocation was reputedly gentle and quick so long as you did not struggle against it. He thought about the sense of profound relief that had spread across Alois's face as he was dying in the street. Then he felt a painful jerk at his waist. In under a minute, he was out and on his feet. The evening was upon them in the west. In the east, the sky was going from gray to black. The jeep hit a pothole. My grandfather's head jolted against something metal. In his dream, he was a boy knocking a soup can off a fence post with a brick bat. He woke up. The tires were spattering fresh mud onto the old snow along the roadside. The road skirted a broad stream or narrow stretch of river. Call it the Ruhr. On the opposite bank of the stream, my grandfather could make out the remnant of a railway line. The tracks had been raked up badly by ordnance. Artillery, bombs, or both. They would need to be repaired. That was something for the engineers to tackle once they had resolved the road mining conundrum. My grandfather had not eaten in nearly 3 days. He had not slept more than 4 hours at a stretch since leaving London. He was dehydrated. Likely he was in a kind of delayed or ever-compounding shock. The idea that the 53rd Engineers would soon be called upon to repair that stretch of track on the opposite bank of the Ruhr became confused in my grandfather's mind with memories of the Corps of Engineers training camp in Illinois long ago. The thought that he was going to be handed a maul or a mattock and put to work was more than he could face just then. There was so much torn-up track, and Berlin was still so far away. He went back to sleep. When he woke up the second time, he was sitting propped in the softest bed in Germany on the cleanest sheets. Father Nickel was at his bedside, smoking a GI cigarette. The heavenly bed was built into an alcove of a candlelit room that turned out to be the only room in the house. The bed alcove took up a quarter of the premises. The kitchen and hearth, with a wooden table and dining chairs, took up another quarter. The rest was books in crates and piles. A refugee kingdom of books hastily evacuated after the collapse of St. Dominic's, a library in exile. "Ah!" Father Nickel said when he saw that my grandfather was awake again. "Here he is." "Hey!" a chair leg scraped. Diddon's loomed out of the flickering shadows. His face was veiled in steam from a bowl of chicken stew that he held in his palm. In his other hand he gripped a steel spoon. The stew smelled leafy, a meadow smell, almost like mint. When my grandfather encountered it again in my grandmother's cooking, it turned out to be an herb called summer savory. "You okay, Rico?" Diddon said. "Fine," my grandfather said. "How's the foot?" "The old lady patched me up."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah, her name is Fräulein Judith."
My grandfather nodded at the stew.
"Pretty good?"
"Oh, yes," Diddon said.
He went a bit teary-eyed.
"Don't worry, Lieutenant, we left you plenty," Gatto said. He was hunched over his own bowl at the table. "Have some."
A smaller, stouter, older version of Father Nickel rose up from the darkness beyond Gatto, her head wrapped in a dark kerchief. She was reaching toward my grandfather, holding out a bowl and a spoon.
"Perhaps in a minute, ma'am," my grandfather said, nodding to the old woman. Her nose and ears were pinches of bread dough, her dark eyes two currants in poked holes.
"Thank you."
"Yes, in a minute," Father Nickel snapped.
His tone softened as he turned back to my grandfather.
"First, a little of something very nice."
The old priest had been sitting on the chest from the churchyard. Now he crouched beside it the way he had crouched beside Alois dying in the street. With an air of tenderness, he lifted the lid on the crate. He took stock of the situation within. When he emerged from behind the lid, he was holding a big green bottle with a long neck and a squat bottom.
"It is cognac," Father Nickel said.
He pronounced the word with reverence and a French accent.
"Very wonderful cognac."
He handed the bottle to my grandfather. The label was all heraldry and the kind of clerical script you saw lettering diplomas and pound notes, a bunch of French verbiage. Lean and raffish lions flanked a quartered escutcheon. The vintage was 1870.
"Before the phloxera," my grandfather said.
Father Nickel sat back down on the crate. The muddy skirt of his cassock rode up. The soles of his high black boots were holed and patched with tar paper. His high socks were hand-knit and curiously festive, socks that might have been worn by the grandfather in Heidi.
"That's right," he said. "Just before."
"So you take an interest?"
"Purely scientific," my grandfather said. He shook his head and handed the bottle back to Father Nickel.
"But you go right ahead, please, Father."
Father Nickel seemed to consider taking offense.
"You think I put poison in it?"
"I want to see it properly enjoyed," said my grandfather.
Father Nickel took a small oblong glass with a wide foot from a hutch by the table. He filled it halfway with cognac. He took a long swallow. He gasped pleasurably. When he lowered his head to my grandfather again, the offense seemed to have been forgiven.
"Your friends are too trusting. They ate the soup. They took some wine."
The old priest filled a second glass with cognac and handed it to my grandfather. Diddens and Gatto raised their glasses. There was a dark green wine bottle on the table between them. If it had come out of the ground with the cognac, it must be something special. Diddens and Gatto appeared to find it palatable. My grandfather took a sip of the cognac. It came on crackling and hot, like the first hard pulls on a cigar as you were getting it lit. After the blaze of a flavor like tobacco, he tasted something between butter and walnuts, and finally a bittersweet sparkle on his tongue, like a squirt of oil from a crushed grapefruit peel.
"Well?"
"Wonderful," my grandfather said.
"The real treasure, eh?"
The old priest tapped the crate between his legs.
"The rest of it isn't much. Some old silver plate, a telescope, a gold monstrance, an old Bible bound in wizened leather. Beautiful, but so fragile it can't even be opened, let alone read. All of it the work of men. But cognac."
He took another long swallow. He did not need to finish the sentence. His expression made clear his belief in the divine providence of champagne brandy.
"What about the relic, St. Dominic's bone?"
"Ah, yes," the old priest said.
"The left stapes of St. Dominic, no doubt, no doubt. A very precious treasure indeed."
It sounded half-hearted. His hands caressed the cognac bottle.
"A telescope," my grandfather said.
"Is that what you said?"
"Yes, my son."
"Is that a relic, too? Is it some kind of holy telescope?"
"No, it is a Zeiss telescope. It is my personal property."
He smiled. "I did not wish it to fall into enemy hands."
The old priest poured another glass of brandy that had been put into a cask 75 years ago.
"Are you an astronomer?"
"An amateur," Father Nickel said. "I have contributed a few insignificant observations, chiefly lunar.
I also take an interest in astronomy."
"In addition to vine blights?"
"That's right." Then you come under the protection of Dominic, my son.
How is that?
Saint Dominic de Guzman is the patron saint of astronomers.
The old priest looked a little melancholy.
As to the value of that projection at this juncture, I would not care to hazard a guess.
Chapter 14. The soldiers slept in the bed, each in his one-third share of heaven. It was the barn for the old woman and the priest. Diddens had taken pains to calibrate the amount of wine he consumed so that it counterbalanced the pain in his foot. Courageously, Private Gatto had volunteered to scout ahead, as it were, and locate the point where analgesia gave way to excess. Now my grandfather lay staring at the darkness as Gatto and Diddens took shifts, working the stops and pedals of the pipe organ they appeared to have smuggled into the bed. Whenever they fell silent for a few minutes, there would be no sound but his own tinnitus and the intermittent booming of the war at night. It sounded very far away. My grandfather could take no comfort in that distance. He was accustomed by now to feeling grateful that when death settled like a flock of birds around him, it was other men and not him on whom it perched. This gratitude never had anything to do with happiness. After what felt like 2 or 3 hours, he gave up. He extricated himself from the dog pile of Gatto and Diddens and climbed down from the bed in its niche. In the profundity of the rural dark, he groped for his trousers, his boots, somebody's overcoat. At sunset, the weather had shown promise of clearing, and my grandfather thought about opening the crate to look for the telescope the old priest had mentioned. He found the top front edge of the crate with his shin. He knelt beside it and felt for the hasp. In the end, he could not bring himself to lift the lid, discouraged in a way that he found mystifying by the presence of St. Dominic de Guzman's stirrup bone. He went out into the yard between the barn and the farmhouse. Father Nichols sat, hunched on a tall stool, his telescope pointed at the sky. For a city boy like my grandfather, the number of visible stars had always been only a dim fraction of the 5,000 or so he knew were visible to the naked human eye. Even in Rapide Parish there was ambient light enough to conceal the true madness of the heavens. On a clear night, in blacked-out countryside, in between bomber runs when the tracer fire ceased and the searchlights went dark, the stars did not fill the sky so much as coat it like hoar frost on a window pane. You looked up and saw the starry night, he told me. You realized that Van Gogh was a realist painter. Tonight, however, as my grandfather joined Father Nickel at the telescope, the stars were lost in the dazzle of a full moon. Also, of course, a large swath of Westphalia was on fire. Smoke cobwebbed the vault of night. You should rest.
No doubt.
My grandfather reached into the left hip pocket of the coat he was wearing and found a 10-pack carton of Lucky's. So it was Gatto's coat. He tore open a pack and offered a Lucky to Father Nickel. Neither of them had a light. My grandfather crept back into the house with a piece of straw and lit it in the embers of the hearth. Once he got a cigarette going, he lit Father Nichols and carried it back out to the priest. They looked up at the moon, hung from the sky like a mirror.
"Permit me to show you my little mountain," Father Nichols said.
My grandfather hunched over the oculus of the telescope. It was an old but excellent telescope, lovingly maintained. Father Nickel had fitted the eyepiece with a lunar filter to reduce the glare of moonlight. The resultant detail came as a shock. The rays of craters were sharp as cracks, starring a mirror. The edge of the lunar disk was toothed like the blade of a circular saw. Somewhere in the center of the Montes Apenninus, according to the old priest, rose little Mons Gallienus.
"You see Mons Huygens?" he said. "You know it?"
Yes, I see it. Now look perhaps 3 degrees of arc to the southeast. You will see a shadow, a patch of gray. To my mind, it resembles the print of a deer's hoof.
Right.
Now, from there, look, let us say, 2 degrees of arc to the northeast.
Okay.
It is there.
Right.
It has an almost castellated appearance.
Ah, you see it?
Yes.
Father Nicol clicked his tongue. You don't see it, he said, not without a trace of bitterness. In fact, due to the Earth's rotation, the image of the moon had already drifted out of the eyepiece. The telescope would have to be slewed.
I'm sure I did, my grandfather said, standing up. Castellated is the perfect word.
Father Nicol grunted. They lit two more cigarettes from the ends of the first and smoked them. They looked at the moon with their unaided eyes. My grandfather shivered and worked himself more deeply into Gatto's overcoat. The snoring was faintly audible from the house. In a coop at the far corner of the farmyard, the remaining chicken, a rooster, muttered to itself, their comrade in insomnia. My grandfather heard a sound like a breeze through treetops, but there was no breeze, and after a moment he decided it must be the river he'd glimpsed earlier from the back of the car. The war, a thud of gunnery, was something he felt rather than heard, a pulse at the hinges of his jaw. My grandfather, taking Father Nicol's long silence for hurt feelings, regretted his failure to seat Mount Gallienus and was about to apologize. But it turned out that Father Nicol's thoughts were elsewhere.
In the 20s there was a kind of rocket mania here, the old priest said. In Germany, the newspapers and magazines were filled with rockets. Rockets to deliver mail, rockets to the moon. Fritz Opel built a rocket car. Every tinkerer and charlatan was going to the moon.
My grandfather mentioned Hermann Oberth, whose Die Rakete zu den Planetenräumen, published in 1923 and discovered in the OSS library during the months he worked for Lovell, had comforted him when, on the hooks of his restlessness, being safe and comfortable and well out of the fight was the worst fate he could imagine.
His book was the start of it, I believe, Father Nicol said. All the rocket madness. Hermann Oberth, yes, a remarkable man, a very advanced thinker.
And then, as if the next words followed logically, no doubt he is now dead. He tap-tapped a cigarette as he pronounced the words tot ist. Glowing orange threads of tobacco scattered from the end of his cigarette.
Oberth worked with Fritz Lang, yes, to make a film, Frau im Mond?
A silly film in many ways, but technically impressive. The particulars of a rocket voyage to the moon were presented in a way that made the business seem credible, not at all far-fetched.
After the film, oh well.
He shook his head. For a moment, Germans to the left, to the right, it didn't matter. Everyone lifted his gaze just for a little moment to the heavens. The old priest squinted up at the brilliance of the moon.
There was earnest discussion about the imminence of lunar travel. One felt it might come very soon, in a matter of a few decades at most.
Certainly I felt it this way. My grandfather had seen the Lang film in the early 30s, under its American title of By Rocket to the Moon at the Model Theater on South Street. In the film, the lunar journey had been affected by the means of a multi-stage rocket, just as described by Hermann Oberth, with what turned out to be remarkable prescience.
In Die Rakete zu den Planetenräumen,
problems of payload, the Earth's gravitation, and the weightlessness of space were presented and solved by ingenious and plausible means. If my grandfather had heard someone predict, as he walked out of the theater on that winter afternoon at the bottom of the Great Depression, that it would require as many as a few decades to conquer the moon, it would have struck him, then 18 or 19, as absurdly pessimistic.
It was very well done, he agreed. At that time I prepared a memorandum, the old priest said. I wrote to the Curia proposing that the Mother Church ought to prepare itself for the eventuality of a human presence on Luna.
I suggested that at every level, from the liturgical to the eschatological, profound questions must arise from mankind's attainment of that neighboring world. Does the papal doctrine of discovery, for example, apply to the moon as it did to the Indies at the time of Columbus? What will be the fate of the souls of the first Catholic lunar colonists? Almost certainly no more than a handful to begin with, if the sacraments, Holy Communion, confession, and so forth are not available. When we speak of Rex Mundi or Salvator Mundi, is it
to be made explicit, or is it already implied that we intend to say Salvator Mundorum? If we should encounter Selenites, though given the moon's apparent barrenness that seems unlikely, but very well, let us say that having made use of the moon as a way station, humanity proceeds outward to the planet Mars, where it encounters sentient, civilized creatures. Let us say furthermore, I am quoting myself, you understand, the words of my memorandum.
My grandfather said that as he assumed as much.
Let us say, then, that in outward form and even in the internal construction of their organs, these Martians are not so very different from us. Indisputably, they are part of God's creation. Presumably, they are in possession of immortal souls. Can their salvation be assured or even conceived on a world whose feet have never been trod by the feet of Christ? And if it can be conceived, and if we might assure it, then is it not our urgent and solemn duty to carry the word of the Lord across the black gulf of ignorance and damnation as soon as possible, and so on and so forth?
Interesting, my grandfather said.
Oh, do you really think so?
Well, that sort of speculation, it's not something I ordinarily go in for, but
it was all rubbish.
Ah,
pretext, I should say. Any nonsense I could dream up, any sophistry that might persuade the Curia to put its considerable resources into sending a holy mission to Luna. At that moment, as I said, such a voyage seemed far from impossible or impractical. It seemed to be only a matter of time.
Naturally, I proposed myself as the prelate on this mission, despite my age. I was strong and healthy. I still am, considering.
And to fly in a rocket through the void of space to the moon, like a hero out of Verne or Wells, to stand there, gazing up at the fat turquoise globe in the heavens. My calling to the priesthood came only in my 20s. A trip to the moon is something I have longed for all my life.
For the first time in what felt like years, but could have been no more than 5 weeks, since 2 or 3 minutes before Alvin Allenval caught the bullet that killed him, my grandfather laughed.
"Please laugh," Father Nichols said with a show of generosity. "Laugh at your foolish old enemy."
My grandfather saw moonlight welling in the old priest's eyes. He put a hand on Father Nichols' shoulder.
"The only difference between you and me, Father," my grandfather said, "is that I never wrote it all down."
Chapter 15. Somewhere out there, beyond the tempered glass visor of his helmet, a fire bell clanged. This did not concern my grandfather. There was no oxygen here to feed a fire or to carry the vibration from the tongue of a bell. Here the enemies were cold and silent. He was warm in his moon suit, however, and he could hear his own heart beating. Bounding along the lunar surface in long arcs, 500,000 miles from the Earth and its fires and alarms. Let it burn. Let it melt. Let its rafters give way. Let the whole thing collapse under the weight of its own sad gravity. The only thing spoiling his lunar idol was the infernal itching at the back of his neck where the helmet attached, impossible to scratch in his suit and gloves of rubberized silk. And that rich smell of compressed air from the tanks on his back, so oddly reminiscent of warm dung.
"Herr Lieutenant?"
My grandfather opened his eyes in the dark. A recent disturbance among the cows below reverberated in the clanging of their bells. A straw from the bale he had been using for a pillow was jabbing him in the neck. He discerned Father Nichols' head and neck peeping over the edge of the loft, hands gripping the ladder. My grandfather scratched the back of his neck. He was glad to have been wakened, contemptuous as ever of the happiness to be found in dreams, displeased with himself for having fallen prey to it once again.
"I'm sorry to wake you, Lieutenant."
There was something concealed in a fold of the old priest's voice. My grandfather sat up, shaking loose the last lunar strands of gossamer.
"Didn't?"
"Asleep. Private Gatto, too. They are both well. Do not worry."
My grandfather looked around for the old woman. When he had climbed into the loft a few hours earlier, he had tried without success not to wake her. He had apologized, and with the twang of the local dialect, Fräulein Judith had apologized for her brother's rudeness. She referred to Father Nickel as the little Pasha. She said that having been born a baby and finding he enjoyed it, he had never bothered to stop. The light of the moon filtering in through a chink painted two portraits of itself on the old woman's eyes.
"He will die without ever having spent a night on anything but goose down," she had said.
My grandfather had assured her that the switch was all his idea.
"The bed is much too comfortable," he'd explained. Evidently there had been truth in this, since after spreading Gato's overcoat across his body, he had immediately fallen into sleep with all its treacheries. At some point the old woman had crept out of her blankets and down the ladder without his even noticing.
"She went to draw water," Father Nickel said. "She will have our breakfast for us when we get back."
"Oh," my grandfather said, "are we going somewhere?"
"That is up to you."
In the darkness, my grandfather could not read the expression on Father Nickel's face. The tone of the old priest's voice was hard to interpret. Anticipation might be doubt. Urgency might be mischief. It sounded as if the old priest had made up his mind to do my grandfather a kindness that he feared he would live to regret.
"Come," he said, "I have a gift for you. Come see."
He lowered himself back down the ladder. My grandfather reached for his boots and dragged Gato's coat to the edge of the loft. He swung his legs over, but then sat without moving at the top of the ladder. Reason, common sense and experience conferred, and came to the conclusion, not without regret, that the night was taking a decided turn toward the fucked up. Regardless of how long ago the cognac you had drunk was put into its bottle and how many chickens had died for the sake of your stew, the war was not over. Father Nickel was the enemy.
"I'm sorry, Father, unless you tell me right now."
"It's a rocket, fool," the old priest said. "A damned rocket."
My grandfather climbed down from the loft and pulled on Gatto's coat. The cows made way, pots and pans, a bovine fart. The old priest went out. My grandfather followed, wondering if his ability to smell something off about a situation had deserted him. The night, an hour before dawn, was very cold. My grandfather buttoned up the coat and jammed his hands into the pockets. Father Nickel appeared to be headed toward an outbuilding at the back of the farm, a garage by the look of it. My grandfather relaxed a little. The rocket that the old priest intended to show him must be a bit of handiwork. Solid fuel, battery ignition welded from a section of pipe, the kind of thing they printed plans for in Popular Mechanics. The story began to write itself in my grandfather's imagination. For a year, 2 years, 5 years, the old priest had waited for some response to his memorandum from the Curia. And then, one day, just as hope began to tip into disappointment, he had run across the article in a magazine or a Sunday newspaper, "The Fascinating New Hobby of Amateur Rocketry." Detailed instructions, step-by-step photographs, a list of materials. Like a group of exiles recreating a lost homeland in a few city blocks, the old priest had been able to replicate his lost hope in miniature, to build a scale model of his dream. And now all this nocturnal hugger-mugger because with the outbreak of war, as was the case in Britain, the Nazis had outlawed amateur rocketry. My grandfather felt a renewed squeeze of affection for this lonely old humanist, holding up night after night in his sister's garage to engineer, at least in his imagination, the means of transport and escape. Just before they reached the old garage, Father Nickel cut abruptly to the right. He tramped past the ruins of a pig pen, past a squat water tank, past a garden whose beds were still cloaked against the winter in sheets of burlap. At the edge of the farm, what appeared to be a large forest stretched away into the distance of the night. Pine and fir trees stood together as if conspiring to keep out the moonlight, hiding a profound darkness behind their backs. Father Nickel headed directly toward those trees and that darkness. Some trick of the moonlight made it appear to my grandfather's suddenly spooked imagination as if the trees had all at once, just a moment before, stopped in their tracks. They held an air of restless hesitation. My grandfather came to a halt. Half of the American soldiers killed or wounded since D-Day had come to grief in woods like this. "What rocket?" he said. "Whose rocket?" "Your rocket, my son," Father Nichols said. When he saw that my grandfather continued to linger, he said, "Listen, I know you are hunting for rockets." "Now?" said experience, common sense and reason. "Christ, you idiot, what the fuck is it going to take?" Gatto kept a carton of Lucky Strikes in the left hip pocket of his overcoat. In the right hip pocket, apparently, he kept a looted Walther PPK, wearing its shark-like leer. My grandfather had never held one before. You could feel the homicide trapped inside it. He had told the old priest nothing about his work, the mission, unless he had blabbed about it at some point in his sleep. That was the kind of thing that happened in spy novels and romances, muttered revelations of conspiracy, adultery, crime. But it struck my grandfather as unlikely. A creation of novelists and screenwriters, like total amnesia and hand-to-hand combat between men who were carrying guns. In his experience, the things people said while they were asleep were even less intelligible than the things they saw. At any rate, except for the occasional appearance put in by his Yiddish-speaking mother, my grandfather dreamed in English. It was hard to imagine that if he had talked in his sleep, the words would have come out as German. There was no telling, however, what Diddens or Gatto, drugged on chicken stew and drunk on wine, might have confessed. After a certain number of years, a priest probably came to elicit confessions without even trying. "Apologies," Entschuldigung, to my grandfather's ear, always the most beautiful of German words. Away to the north and northeast, the war pulsed at my grandfather's temples and the hinges of his jaws like a headache coming on. "I must insist, Father, that you tell me where you are taking me now." In the moonlight, he could not be entirely certain, and no doubt his conscience or 40 years of accumulated retrospective tenderness influenced his impression, as reported to me, that when Father Nichol saw the gun in my grandfather's hand, he looked heartbroken. He simply nodded, and when he spoke, his tone was patient and forgiving. "In the winter, you see, in December or January, they started to route the trains this way, from somewhere up in the Harz Mountains, I believe, to the rail yards at Zuest and thence west. At some point, they were loading them on the beds of special lorries, camouflaged under netting and driving them within range of Antwerp, and, of course, London. For the trains to deviate this far to the south before turning west, well, it's very much the long way around, isn't it? I presume the more direct routes were bombed, and then when the retreat from Belgium began, there was no other way. In time, things became chaotic around Suez, which has been bombed very heavily, very heavily. Often the trains passing this way were obliged to stop. There's a siding along the river just down the hill from here. They would sit and wait on this siding for an hour, 2 hours. And then, you see, one night when the train carried on, one of them had been left behind, abandoned. I still do not know why. I must assume that it was damaged in transit or found to be somehow defective. No doubt they are fragile. Deadly things often are. Come, you're saying that on the other side of these woods there is a V-2? Yes, an intact V-2 rocket. If this turned out to be true, it would be, as far as my grandfather knew, the first such capture by any of the blacklist teams. It would be a spectacular prize. Yes, yes, through these woods. And then down the hill there's a path. With the snow all gone, it's nothing, a walk of 20 minutes, perhaps, for a young man. Twice that since you shall be in my enfeebled company. Come. Just before he followed the priest, whose ward and beloved sexton he had murdered only a few hours before, into the darkness at the back of the trees, my grandfather took a look up. A last look up, it might be, at the stars. The moon was down, and they had reclaimed the whole of the sky. At that hour, all across Europe, if the local skies were clear, people who believed, knew, feared, or hoped they were about to die were looking up at the stars. From Finland to the Balkans, from the Black Sea to the doorstep of Africa, across Poland and Hungary and Romania. Looking up, maybe, through a pane of perspex or through lenses that corrected for myopia, through a tangle of razor wire, a gun slit, a grid of tracer fire, the blown hatch of an M1. Standing, stumbling, kneeling, dead on their feet or running for their lives, from open fields, street gutters, and foxholes, atop a pile of rubble in a fresh-dug ditch, on a Turkish carpet in a house that had no roof, on the deck of a ship on fire. No doubt some of these people, looking up at the stars, sought the lineaments of God's face. Many saw no more than what was to be seen, the usual spatter of lights, cold and far away. For some, the sky might be a diagram captioned in Arabic and Latin, a dark hide tattooed with everyday implements and legendary beasts. At least one man, looking up at the stars that night from the edge of a forest in the Westerwald, saw an archipelago of atomic furnaces and a vacuum sea, omnidirectional vectors of acceleration, radiant from a theoretical point of origin that predated humanity by billions of years, as unperturbed by mechanized mass slaughter on a global scale as by the death of one individual. This was my grandfather's line of thinking, and he found both comfort and guidance in it. He could trust or mistrust Father Nickel. Either way, the outcome would mean nothing to the stars. So why not, for one night, lay down the weary burden of mistrust? For an hour, say, and no longer, just long enough to see the rocket. After that, he would shoulder the burden again. "So what happened?" I said. "What did he do?" I had been schooled by now in the ways of South Philadelphia and the world that was, in my grandfather's view, its macrocosm. I was expecting treachery, mischance, one debt incurred when another was repaid. "He showed me the rocket," my grandfather said. "A V-2. You saw a V-2 rocket." "I saw more than one. This was just the first." "And?" "And? What was it like?" He pursed his lips and angled his face toward the window. He considered the question for long enough that I began to wonder if he had forgotten it. "It was tall."
"Tall?"
"The old man said it was as tall as the steeple of his church."
"Okay,"
I said. I hadn't pictured them as being so tall. "But I mean, how did you feel? What did you think?"
"I don't know how to put it into words."
"Were you disappointed?"
"On the contrary."
"Afraid?"
"Of what? It wasn't going anywhere."
It occurred to me that neither disappointment nor fear was an emotion my grandfather ever really struggled to express. Both could be stated plainly and left behind.
"Did it make you happy?"
I said. The word seemed to catch him a little off guard.
"Something like that," he said.
In children's drawings, monkeys eat bananas, and every rocket is a V-2. Even after decades of stepped-back multi-stage behemoths, chunky orbiters, and space planes, the mid-century modern Enterprise, the polyhedral bulk of Imperial Star Destroyers and Borg Cubes, the ortho-cyclin disk of Millennium Falcon, in our deepest imaginations, the surest way to the nearest planet remains a trim cigar, tapering to a pointed nose cone, poised on the tips of four swept-back axial fins. By the time I became conscious of rockets, and I grew up at the height of the space race, surrounded by the working models and scale models my grandfather's company manufactured, by photographs and drawings of Saturns and Atlases and Arabes and Titans, they had progressed well beyond von Braun's early masterwork, in design as in power, size, and capacity. But it was a V-2 that would carry me into the outer space of a fairground ride that labeled the spines of the public library's science fiction collection. A V-2 was the weenie, or visual anchor, of Walt Disney's Tomorrowland. In the V-2, Form and purpose were united, as with a knife, a hammer, or some other fundamental human tool. As soon as you saw a V-2, you knew what it was for. You understood what it could do. It was a tool for defeating gravity, for escaping the confines of Earth. For my grandfather, I believe, the war was everything that happened to him from the day he enlisted until the moment he walked into a clearing in the woods outside Wellinghausen, Germany, in late March or early April 1945. It was everything that resumed happening, the awful things he saw and the revenge he contemplated, from the moment he walked out of the clearing until the German surrender 6 weeks later. The 30 minutes or so that he spent with the rocket in the woods, however, was time stolen from the war, time redeemed. He would leave the clearing with that half hour cupped in his memory like an egg kept warm in the palms. Even when the war had crushed it, he remembered the pulse, the quickening of something that might break free and take to the sky. When they walked into the clearing, the old priest sat down on an upended packing crate, crossed his legs, and lit a cigarette. The far-off pounding of artillery came to a momentary halt, and in the interval before the first birds, as the darkness deepened, some power seemed to enter and flow across the clearing. After a moment, my grandfather identified that tide as silence. Then a bird sang and the sky lightened, and you could begin to see the rocket aspiring to heaven on its mobile launch table. My grandfather divined its purpose with an upward leap of the heart. Of course, my grandfather knew that from the point of view of German command, of Allied command, of Hermann Göring and General Eisenhower and the people at whom it was to have been launched, the rocket was still, was only, the war. The clearing had been cut by soldiers. The rocket had been transported here by soldiers. Soldiers would have armed, primed, aimed, and fired it. Like its fellows, around 3,000 between September 1944 and March 1945, it had been fitted with a warhead that contained 2,000 pounds of a highly explosive form of TNT that would detonate on impact. Its manufacture had been ordained and carried out not to bear humankind to the doorstep of the stars, but to atomize and terrorize civilians, destroy their homes, shatter their morale. If some unknown mischance had not intervened, this rocket would have joined its fellows in racing the sound of its own arrival toward the city of Antwerp, where on December 16th, to take the worst example, a V-2 had fallen on the Rex Theater in the middle of a showing of The Plainsman, killing or injuring nearly 1,000 people. None of that, however, could be blamed on the rocket, my grandfather thought, or on the man, von Braun, who had designed it. The rocket was beautiful. In conception, it had been shaped by an artist to break a chain that had bound the human race ever since we first gained consciousness of Earth's gravity and all its analogues in suffering, failure, and pain. It was at once a prayer sent heavenward and the answer to that prayer, "Bear me away from this awful place." To pack the thing with a ton of amatol, to hobble it so that instead of tearing loose once and for all from the mundane pull, it only arced back to Earth and killed the people among whom it fell, was to abuse it. It was like using a rake to whip egg whites, a dagger to pick your teeth. It could be done, but to do so was a perversion, furthermore ineffective. As a weapon, a tool of strategy, it was clear to everyone by now that the V-2 had failed. Yes, 4,000 or 5,000 hapless Frenchmen, Belgians, and Englishmen had been killed by the rocket bombs. Tens of thousands more had been left wounded, homeless, or afraid, but in the end, bombs of the ordinary variety had killed, maimed, and frightened people in far more terrible numbers. And now here were the Allies deep into Germany, and the rockets were impotent and no longer fell. My grandfather felt sorry for Werner von Braun, whom he could not help envisioning as shy, professorial, wearing a cardigan. His pity for and anger on behalf of the imaginary von Braun tapped the reservoir of his sorrow over the loss of Auenbach. Alvin Auenbach, with a hint of Paul Henreid. The poor bastard. He had built a ship to loft us to the very edge of heaven, and they had used it as a messenger of hell.
"Lieutenant," Father Nichols said.
He put a hand on my grandfather's shoulder.
My grandfather averted his face. Automatically, he moved to shrug off the old priest's hand, but in the end, he left it where it was. Between him and Father Johannes Nickel, as between two stars, lay unbridgeable gulfs of space-time. And yet across the sweep of that desolation, each had swum for a moment into the other's lens.
Poor von Braun.
He needed to know. My grandfather felt that he must find him and tell him that such a thing was possible. Scattered in the void were minds capable of understanding, of reaching one another. He would put his hand on von Braun's shoulder the way the old priest's gnarled paw now lay benedictive on his own. He would transmit to von Braun the only message lonely slaves of gravity might send. We see you. We are here.
Chapter 16. In 1972, Uncle Ray recruited my father, then employed as team doctor to the Washington Senators, to invest in his latest undertaking, a chain of fancy billiards clubs called Gatsby's that served liquor and welcomed female customers with Tiffany-style lamps and foofy cocktails. At its peak, just preceding its complete extinction, the chain encompassed five locations in Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh. In decor, the clubs combined elements of Gentlemen's Club, traditional chop house, and the then-popular Fern Bar. In concept, the undertaking combined elements of pipe dream, tax dodge, money laundering scheme, and irretrievable mistake. Uncle Ray was not entirely forthcoming to my father about the identity of their silent partners, and my father was not entirely forthcoming, it seems, about the extent to which he was already a focus of attention for having failed to report income to the IRS. Anyone who cares to waste a few hours among the archives of the Post, Sun, Inquirer, and Post-Gazette may trace the fragmentary outlines of their disaster, which cost my great-uncle a beating that left him hospitalized for weeks and made my father a quasi-fugitive for the rest of his life. I don't have the space or the stomach to go into the details here, and anyway, the Gatsby's debacle was barely a footnote, if that, in the history of the Philadelphia mob. In my family, naturally, it proved of more significance. With Uncle Ray facing criminal charges, and my father in the wind, my grandparents and my mother were left holding a variety of bags. My grandfather constructed a defensive array of high-impact lawyers. But even with this shield in place, there were penalties, liabilities, and liens. To raise the necessary funds, he forced a reluctant Uncle Sammy to buy out his interest in MRX, and the happiest, or at least the most productive period of his life, came to an end. Less than a year after he lost the company he loved, he lost my grandmother, too. By the time he met Sally Cecil, almost nothing of value was left apart from the condo, which my grandmother had been able to visit only once after its purchase, and 57 model spacecraft built to a rigorous scale from premium materials. From his private stock, my grandfather culled 10 of the best, including a sweet little Sputnik PS2 that obliged you, if you lifted a hinged panel, to contemplate the awful fate of a tiny Leica, a modified husky pinched from an N-scale Alaskan railroad kit. 3 days after meeting Sally, he sold all 10 of the rockets to the Bluestein twins up in Cocoa Beach. He used the proceeds to pay Devon and purchase the supplies he would need to hunt down the snake that had eaten Ramon. Every night at 9, except Sunday, Devon would meet my grandfather at a Waffle House, drive him to Atlantis, and drop him at the gate with its gaffed lock. My grandfather would schlep off into the darkness, laden with his gear, canvas sack and work gloves, flashlight, and the panoply of special tools he had crafted. Snake hook, vinyl-coated storage hook welded to the end of an old golf club. Snake stick, a length of narrow-gauge PVC pipe fitted with a noose of nylon cord, and, of course, snake hammer. Precisely 2 hours and 35 minutes later, he would return carrying his waders so as not to muddy Devon's car. Then Devon would drive my grandfather back to the Waffle House before starting the midnight shift at Fontana Village.
Every night?
Except Sunday. Sunday Devon went to church.
I must have talked to you during that time, right?
I'm on the phone with you, and you're telling me you had rice pudding for dessert or whatever, and meanwhile you're getting ready to go snake hunting. He registered my pointless question and then looked away.
Fine, I said.
Why?
You saw the show, Alien Invaders. It wasn't eating just pets. It was eating a wide and troubling variety of native birds and amphibians.
Oh, really?
Endangered species.
And house cats.
It was an alien invader, didn't belong there.
Humans don't belong there either, I said.
Why didn't you hunt them?
I don't know, he said. I guess I never got around to it.
But I mean, it was really all about Sally, wasn't it?
What was about Sally? What are you talking about?
The snake had been eating pets for months. You didn't care.
Then you met Sally.
All of a sudden, you want to kill the thing.
You were doing it for her sake.
Was I?
Grandpa, come on.
Maybe.
Totally.
Well, my grandfather said, there are worse reasons for killing, believe me.
My grandfather took Sally to an overpriced crab house in Boynton Beach, a rope-trimmed tourist trap that my grandmother had despised. On the way home, as though her ghost had poisoned his chowder, my grandfather experienced cramps. As a rule, he avoided shellfish and pork because, while he had long since left his religion in the Neolithic, where he felt it belonged, he retained, in his words, a kosher belly. The trouble in his stomach embarrassed him obscurely, so he kept it to himself. It would be a matter of getting to a toilet as soon as possible. On the way home from the crab house, he obliged himself to drive patiently. The effort required kept his mind off the pain.
"Good Lord, I just remembered," he said.
He had parked the Le Sabre, and they were walking toward Sally's cluster of units through the luminous Florida dark. She had invited him to come have a look at her place. Curiosity about the interior arrangements of one another's units was a kind of currency at Fontana Village, one in which even my grandfather traded. There was not necessarily anything more to her invitation, he had decided, than that.
I think I might have forgotten to unplug my soldering iron.
That afternoon he had recapped a buzzing old Zenith at the request of his neighbor, Pearl Abramowitz. There was nothing he had been able to do for Pearl's other complaint, that increasingly all the people singing and talking on her radio seemed to be doing so in Spanish. He had, however, remembered to turn off the soldering iron. It was not even a question of remembering. He had made a habit of it. That was the purpose of habit, in my grandfather's view, to render memory unnecessary. He could see that he had let Sally down, but he covered it with a joke.
"I've only known you 3 days," she said, "but that doesn't sound like something you would forget."
This was undeniable.
"No, but if I don't check..."
"Of course, I totally understand."
"I'll be over in 10 minutes, 5 minutes."
"Go." He hurried back to his unit and repaired to the bathroom, where fighting, though fierce, was mercifully brief. He washed up and discharged 3 precise bursts of Alpine summer air freshener. He went back out to the living room. The yellow sofa, the whitewashed wicker etagere, the expressionless walls had a disintoxicating effect on his imagination. He saw the elaborate scale model of LAV-1 on its mound of simulated lunar surface, on which he had lavished thousands of hours and dollars for what it was. 5 pounds of painted plastic scrap, sitting on $10 worth of plaster cloth and chicken wire. What was he doing, chasing after Sally Cecil? Asking her out. So improbably on a date. The recliner they'd had since Riverdale, in which my grandmother used to sit, watching Jeopardy and yelling deliberately incorrect guesses at the screen, as though trying to throw the contestants off their game,
leveled its mute reproach.
Sit, it seemed to implore him. Stay. Slacken. Vegetate.
The telephone rang. It was Sally.
You all right?